Welcome to the Progress Your Health podcast with your hosts, Dr. Robert Mackey and Dr. Valerie Davidson, a husband and wife team who specialize in bioidentical hormone replacement therapy and functional medicine. They're here to help you lose weight, balance hormones, and age gracefully. It's their mission to motivate, educate, and empower you to take your health to the next level. And now your hosts, hormone experts, Dr. Mackey and Dr. Davidson.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Progress Your Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
Good morning. How are you doing today? How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I do see you every day, so I sort of know how you are. But, you know, it always a little, obviously, this is being recorded, so we, you know, stop and start a couple of times. And once we get started, we really don't edit anything. We just kind of talk in the beginning. Like if the intro part of getting it started seems a little bit awkward, we might start over or something. But once we get rolling, we really don't edit anything. It's we just try to just have a conversation about a particular question.
Yeah, no, exactly. This is actually our second start. But once we get rolling, it's great. Second start because, I don't know, I felt like there were rocks in my mouth or something. And I was being a little procrastinating doing this. I don't know why, because I'm not a procrastinator by nature. But hey, we're in the saddle.
Well, we haven't, we had a bunch of things going on. So we took some time off from the podcast. We had a new website designed, so if you were seeing this again, you should probably have already seen the new website. And we ran into a couple of problems that kind of slowed everything down, as typical, right? You know, technology and just, you know, things always take longer than you expect. But when you're not doing it on a consistent basis, it does build up some resistance. And it's almost like the longer you go, the harder it is to actually sit back down and, you know, actually do it. Once you and I are sitting here, it's actually very fun and enjoyable. And you get done, it's like, oh, that's really kind of motivating. It's very inspiring. It kind of gives you a nice little surge of energy. I think that part's cool, but you know, sometimes the hardest part is actually just whatever it is, whether it's changing your diet, maybe starting an exercise program, anything like that. There's always that little bit of resistance that we have. I think that's part of the human consciousness or the human experience that we. Things that we know we should be doing, whatever capacity that is, there's this part of our mind that doesn't want us to do it for some reason. Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure. Like you said, with exercise or even like in the morning when we go for a walk, sometimes it's like, once you get out there, it's great, but kind of getting your shoes on and getting outside, I don't know. Like I said, this morning probably took me an hour and a half to get into this room. And then I was, I have to put my phone and my watch in another room so I'm not distracted. Maybe I should make some tea. And it's kind of felt like a squirrel.
Yeah, a little bit. You kind of get little ADHD or something. You're like distracted with all these things. That's why, it can be really challenging. There's a book. His name is Steven Pressfield. He wrote a book a number of years ago called The War of Art. And he talks about the resistance, that it's like this, like it's this real thing that you just have to sit down and do it. And I think that it portrays not just creating, right? We're content creating right now, a blog post, a podcast, a YouTube video, all that stuff is creation. But that creative process is sometimes very challenging, right? It takes a lot of work and effort, one, just to sit down and actually do it, and then to do it over and over and over again. The War of Art, Stephen Pressfield, it's a very short book. He's got a couple other ones that are kind of along the same lines. But his idea, there's the muse, if you sit down and do your work on a regular basis, the creative thoughts or the creative gods, I'm not exactly sure the words he used, actually reward you. And that turns into some kind of a good written literary, he's a writer, of course, turns into some kind of a, well-produced, well-written kind of manuscript of some sort. But you have to, I think another book he has is like Turning Pro or something, like how you become a professional in whatever you're doing, but literally in a creative space. Like, we see patients all the time. We're just talking about this. When you're seeing patients a lot, there's a certain mindset you have when you're seeing as a clinician, and there's a certain mindset you have when you're content creating. It's in some ways completely different. Your mind works differently when you're trying to be the clinician versus trying to content create.
Oh, yeah. No, with that creation. In fact, when I do have patient care days afterwards, I think, okay, I'm going to work on this and write this and, you know, create this. And then afterwards, I'm like, no, I need something maybe, I don't know, more easier to do, because it is hard to sometimes create that art. When you were mentioning that book, it reminded me of a book I read several years ago. I don't even know the name of the author. It was such a good book about eating the big frog first. And I'm always like that. Like, hey, let's get the big job done first and then we'll do the other stuff. But I don't know what happened this morning.
Yeah, you and I are the opposite that way. You like to eat the big frog first, and I'm sort of the procrastinator that doesn't want to do the big frog ever, right? Yeah, so you and I are like, you're good at that. You always want to do the thing that you don't want to do the most. You want to get it done as quickly as possible. I think that's
efficiently and well. I mean,
yeah. I think most of the time, I think that's actually a really good. You know, it keeps you productive in getting things done. I think it's really a good quality that way. Now, granted, sometimes it can be, you know, in certain situations, maybe, but procrastination is obviously not, you know, really great. That's my specialty. I can procrastinate with the best of them.
Hey, we're all developing.
Yeah. So we have, of course, another question. I think this woman, I don't think she gives her name on this one. You know, so that's, I don't think there's a name listed.
And we always change the names anyway.
But there's a clue in there. She gives some cholesterol numbers, but I think she's from either England or from Europe somewhere, because the number she gives doesn't translate well to the American numbers. We'll read the numbers off. I think they're units. I think our units are milligrams per deciliter, not that anybody cares. And I think for cholesterol over there, it's millimoles per liter. Not that anyone knows what those things mean, but it's just, you know, the way the, you know, the units play out in the American system, or the units that are used in America versus other parts of the world. Yeah, so go ahead and read the question.
So I'll read the question. It says, hi, I'm a healthy and uber fit 60-year-old woman who has been menopausal for 10 years. My chief complaint is GSM, which GSM is kind of the new phrase for that used to be called vaginal atrophy. It stands for genital urinary syndrome of menopause. So we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But she goes on to say, I have been on 10 micrograms Vagifem for this entire time, 3 to 6 times per week. That's something that you insert into the vaginal tissues or the vaginal vault to help with that, the GSM or the vaginal atrophy. Then she goes on to say, well, it's been well controlled. So her GSM is well controlled. My cholesterol is 7, which is technically high. Like I said, our units are different. LDL is 3.5. HDL is 3.28. I saw a pharmacist who is a BHRT specialist, and she recommends 0.25 milligrams of Biest, 100 milligrams of progesterone, and possibly testosterone, depending on my levels. She thinks this will balance my hormones better, possibly improve my lipid profile, protect my heart and bones. Am I too late in the game for the BHRT? Do you agree with her suggestions?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. You know, I think the reference range, when I looked it up, that's why I think she's from the UK, that it's her, if the reference range is millimoles per liter, hers should be less than 5 and hers is at 7 for a total cholesterol. You know, this comes up a lot, right? Cause we're dealing with women in their 40s, 50s, and 60s all the time. So everyone's, you know, and even their husbands that we end up working with, they're always worried about their cholesterol levels. Based on my research and my opinion, I don't think the total really means much. I think the total is a little bit overblown. I don't know how that translates necessarily to her dosing, you know, per se. You know, that could just be, you know, her being in menopause. I don't know if the Vagifem is contributing to that necessarily. The other two numbers is hard to translate what those should be compared to the American units.
But they are pretty even. The LDLs, which is technically the low density lipoproteins, the lousy, the lower the better, is 3.5. And her HDL, the high density lipoproteins, the higher the better, that's the beneficial, is 3.28. They're pretty even, and I bet that's, and usually to raise that HDL, to have such good HDLs, is because, like she said, she's uber fit from her exercise.
Yeah. Probably, you know, she probably has a pretty reasonable diet. Probably, like I said, if she's uber fit, then she's exercising quite a bit. I think the reference range for the HDL was like greater than 1.4. So she's almost double that. Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing that's not on there, I know this is not about the hormones, but again, because who we work with, these cholesterol things come up quite often, is they don't have a triglyceride level on there. And I personally think that the triglyceride level, the triglyceride and the HDL level That is actually a really, important number that sort of gets gets dismissed a lot. Everyone's focused on cholesterol when they really should be more focused on some of those other numbers. Total really means not much. Now, if it's over 300 or 350 or 450, okay, fine. Maybe should be concerned. But, the triglyceride, wouldn't it be curious to know what that number was for her?
Yeah, don't you do an equation with the triglycerides and the HDLs to kind of give you an idea about insulin resistance?
Yeah. So one of the doctor crushes that I have, a man crush on a researcher from BYU. His name is Dr. Ben Bickman, and he wrote a book a few years ago called Why We Get Sick. I think it's a great book. I've always been into that insulin thing for a long time, and he talks about doing a calculation: triglycerides divided by HDL. Okay, so let's say the reference range for triglycerides, 0 to 150, right, for triglycerides in America, an average, what would you say an average woman's HDL is?
Oh, yeah, women tend to have higher HDLs compared to men, usually, 55, 65. Yeah,
I was going
to
say at least.
Some women in their 80s.
Yeah, I was going to say usually at least 60, right? Mm-hmm. And women are not going to struggle too much to have an HDL above 50, 60 maybe being an average. I've seen them for a woman as high as 135, like really high in the hundreds.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
So a really good, in my opinion, and again, this is not just based on, I'm not a cardiologist, obviously, but we've done a lot of research on this and paid attention to some other doctors like Dr. Bickman and Dr. Peter Attia and some other ones, that ratio, triglycerides divided by HDL, when you do the math, that should be less than 1.5. So triglycerides divided by HDL, that number should come out to be, now it probably wouldn't work with the reference, with the units that
That's
she gave
true.
Us, right?
Yeah,
because we're basing it on United States units that we use, milligrams per deciliter or whatever it is. That ratio should be less than 1.5. Okay, so what you want there is you want a low triglyceride. That correlates well with having a low insulin level. Okay, insulin resistance leads to all those problems, heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's, cancer. And then a high HDL is sort of like the protective part of that. So it's just a little bit of a different way to sort of evaluate those lipid numbers and decide. Another test that should be run also adding to that, which we're going to add to our kind of screening test for new patients, is an ApoB, apolipoprotein B, which is how you sort of differentiate the LDL. The LDL is, of course, as we know, the bad cholesterol, but just looking at the total number of the LDL you don't know if it's bad or not. Some of it might be bad, but the ApoB is how you differentiate. If you have let's say an LDL of 150, is that number fine or is it not fine? The ApoB helps you kind of further dive into that and understanding what your actual risk is. And we're going to do probably another podcast in the future about those numbers and, look at calcium CT score, coronary calcium score, a CT angiogram, right? These are some new technologies that are becoming more and more popular to help understand some of that risk. Okay, so now let's transition back a little bit. So sorry for the long, detail about the cholesterol. Now let's go back and talk about her hormones.
So with our question here, she had mentioned seeing that pharmacist, and she's only been on, like I had said, the Vagifem this entire 10 years, 3 to 6 times a week, well-controlled. The Vagifem is more of an insert, so it helps keep those vaginal tissues, because after menopause, when the estrogen and progesterone drop, particularly the estrogen, is those little vaginal cells become smaller, they become what's called parabasal cells or immature vaginal cells, which then can create dryness, pain with intercourse, less lubrication, less resiliencies of the tissues. It used to be called, I've always called it, vaginal atrophy, but I do like the new term that they have now, the GSM, the genitourinary syndrome of menopause, because it encompasses a little bit more about than just the vaginal tissues are dry and not lubricated. Because when that estrogen drops and those tissues become, change in their resiliency and their cellular structure, it does change the actual vaginal vault flora. Like our vaginal canal has its own almost like biome. It's got good bacteria and not so good bacteria and, different, like we've always talked about probiotics. It's got lots of different, critters, and it's kind of got this nice symbiotic balance. When those tissues don't have the estrogen supplied to them and they become atrophic, or, the cellular changes there, where there there's parabasal cells, it actually changes the pH of the vaginal canal, can disrupt that entire flora, making these women way more prone to urinary tract infections, bacterial vaginosis, yeast infections. So for her, I do think, you know, especially postmenopausal women, that let's say they don't want to take hormones or it's not applicable to them, I do think in some ways trying to preserve that vaginal vault flora in some ways is healthy, because, you know, women want to have intercourse, you know, postmenopause. They want to not get urinary tract infections or vaginitis so easily.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's really one of those things you sort of, you know, coach a client, you give them some type of, we'll talk about some of those solutions, but you give them some kind of a, you know, vaginal application of, you know, some type of estrogen. We typically use Estriol in those situations. And sure enough, if it's really bad, that's the woman that's going to get the, you know, the UTI or the yeast infection within 3 to 5 days, right? From exactly what you're talking about. As even more so with some of the commercial ones, because they don't use Estriol, they use estradiol, and it throws off, you know, it just, you know, sort of sets them up for that, you know, problem. And then, of course, what do they do conventionally? They give them either Diflucan, they give them Flagyl, they give them these really powerful antifungals. We use boric acid in those situations a little bit, even though it sounds acid and maybe it sounds like it could be painful, but it's a little bit gentler in that respect. Still solves the problem well. But, you know, again, hers is well controlled now, but in the beginning of that process, they can really, you know, develop an infection really quickly.
So I do think I love the fact, like she says, she's healthy, she's really fit, and that this, you know, the GSM is being, you know, well controlled, that vaginal atrophy. Her question is she too late in the game for that BHRT? So there's a couple of ways, like we had, you know, mentioned earlier in the podcast about kind of teasing this apart. If she were to just take, you know, the biest, the progesterone, and maybe some testosterone transdermally, because most of that, you know, the biest is usually transdermal cream. Testosterone really should always be a transdermal cream when you apply that as BHRT. If she did that, but didn't do anything vaginally, that GSM would come back. The vaginal atrophy would come back, because those tissues, they're always like last in line for the hormones. So whenever I give a woman hormones, I'm always checking in with her about that, those vaginal tissues, because even when their dose is perfect, their blood levels look amazing, they'll still complain like, yeah, I'm having a little lubrication issues or, you know, pain with intercourse. So then we have to do something topical, like Dr. Mackey mentioned, usually always, pretty much always and only do, you know, topical vaginal estriol to the vaginal tissues. So I'm not sure if her pharmacist wants to continue that Vagifem plus add in these hormones, or actually trying to swap it out.
Yeah, when you're trying to do something systemic, that she doesn't complain of any hot flashes or night sweats, so there's no temperature issues or dysregulation going on, that's what you would use a bias for. That's for a systemic purpose. That's not really going to have an impact locally on the vaginal tissue. Or you know, some women use estriol on their faces like an anti-wrinkle cream, right? You're not going to be able to achieve that from using a systemic bias. In those cases, whatever you use locally, it will not translate systemically. Whatever you use systemically will not translate locally. So you sort of have to do both. I mean, most of the time.
That's what I was thinking, kind of looking at this. And like you'd mentioned hot flashes and night sweats, and we talked about this on the previous podcast, that when it comes to menopause, it's not, hot flashes and night sweats are like the tip of the iceberg when it comes to symptoms that women can have. So it would be kind of maybe talking to this patient or this, you know, this person asking the question, you know, what other symptoms that you have that the BHRT would improve? So I know she's talking about her heart and her bones. The exercise, I think, by far is amazing for your heart and your bones. You know, strengthen bones is to do some kind of, you know, weight resistant exercise. So she's probably already got that. But I would, you know, ask her about some of the other symptoms, like how's your sleep? Are you sleeping through the night? How's your mood? Any brain fog? Any short-term memory issues?
Are you angry towards your husband?
Yeah, that's the blog that I'm writing that should come out by the time this podcast is out.
Yeah. Menopause and anger towards husband.
Yes, there can be, yeah, moods. Are you moody? Are you angry? Are you sad? Are you anxious? Are you blue? You know, there's so many things to kind of coalesce together for that particular individual, where somebody else, it might be, hey, I like she sounds like, hey, probably feels really good. She's got energy. She exercises. She eats well. Maybe that cholesterol is a little bit genetically, you know, high. Maybe she might have inherited that. I see that all the time where, you know, the genetics has a part with that. Her bones are probably pretty great from all that exercise. But, you know, we talked about, you know, you can do a bone density scan or a DEXA scan to check her bone density. I'm sure her heart is great. So it's just really kind of seeing, does this person need this for any specific reason?
Yeah, right. Like I said, and the dosing, well, you said 0.25 milligrams, correct?
A biased is an estriol and estradiol combination.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, that's a quarter of a milligram. I mean, if we're talking just from that standpoint, the dosing is just sort of insignificant. She's going to go to that, and then her, you know, the GSM symptoms are going to come back within a month. If not sooner than that. So she sort of needs to do both. But the Vagifem, you know, I never prescribe Vagifem, right? We, you know, for one, it's estradiol. We don't use estradiol vaginally just because it's, you know, the proximity of the uterus. It just, you know, for one, like you talked about earlier, it's more prone to developing the yeast infections and some of those other problems. And two, you know, because it, you know, the vagina there is so close to the uterine, you know, the uterus that, you know, we get just as good success just using the estriol, which usually doesn't have those other issues.
And I have noticed with patients that have been on, you know, estradiol inserts, vaginal inserts, when I run, and they're not on anything else, when I run their blood work for the estradiol, it's actually present in the bloodstream. So I do feel, even though it's supposed, like you had mentioned, hey, that Vagifem is supposed to be local. On a few patients that have come in, you know, they're transferring care, or they want to, you know, be a new patient, and I've run that blood work, I am surprised, because a postmenopausal woman should have an estradiol, you know, very low, because their ovaries are not making it.
Yeah, less than 30. Yeah. Less than 30.
Why would it be present in the bloodstream if she's postmenopausal? So I do feel like sometimes, and maybe it's only for a short amount of time, or maybe they did the insert the night before and did the blood work, you know, 8 hours later or something. But it always kind of boggled me a little bit, and that's why I was always hesitant, because I don't mind any kind of topical, you know, estriol or working on the GSM or the vaginal tissues. But if you feel like it's bleeding, or in some ways, I don't know what the word would be, but matriculating out into the bloodstream that you don't want it to, that isn't a good thing.
And she didn't mention that she's on any progesterone. That's the new suggestion that the pharmacist is recommending, is putting her on some progesterone.
And I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, yeah. That mm-hmm. Using estradiol with no progesterone over a long period of time does not sound like such a great idea. You know, now granted, if a woman, in some ways, when a woman starts BHRT, whether she's 50 or 60, 65, whatever, the fact that she might get some bleeding or does get some bleeding or spotting is actually kind of a good thing, because it gives you a clue that something is going on there. It kind of gives you an idea as the practitioner where her limit is. If you're a woman's on hormones for 10 years and there's nothing going on, you know, bleeding wise, in some ways with no progesterone like that, I don't know if I like that idea too much on a long-term basis. Short-term, you know, 6 months, a year, no big deal. But if she's on that for an extended amount of time, which she would have to be, like you said, the GSM isn't going to go, if she stops the hormones, even using estriol, if you stop those hormones, it's going to just come back. That's why we recommend 1 to 3 times a week dosing. We do not want women to dose it every day.
You mean the estriol?
The estriol, mm-hmm. You know, vaginally, what's the frequency for the Vagifem? Do you know?
It looks like she uses it 3 to 6 times a week. So maybe I'm not, you know, maybe she's just deciding that. Or
yeah, right. Yeah. 3 times is what we usually recommend.
That's plenty.
6 times a week is a little bit much. Maybe of course, more application in the beginning, right, to get those cells kind of used to having the hormone, and then the frequency should go down over time. If she's not taking any progesterone, you know, I don't know if that would do anything, but like you said, now you check a blood level and her estradiol level is, you know, 75 or 100.
Yeah, it would be good. I would say to check that, and she might be doing it a little bit more frequently, because some, you know, after menopause, that urethra can become a little bit lax because of lack of estrogen. And so women will have, you know, a little urinary incontinence. You cough, you laugh, you do some jumping jacks. So I do know, you know, doing some kind of estrogen therapy to the vaginal tissues can help strengthen and sort of tonify that urethra, so it can help quite a bit with that stress incontinence, urinary incontinence.
Yeah. Maybe with a strong sneeze or something, but it's not, you know, stepping off a curb or while they're exercising. It's more, you know, not extreme situations, but more specific ones as opposed to just anything and they're leaking all the time. That's, you know, it can't be convenient for that to happen just sort of randomly.
So that could be the case there. So I do think her question about, you know, let's say that VAGIFEM wasn't matriculating into her bloodstream. Let's say, you know, that's just localized. Her GSM symptoms are great. You know, she's not having any, very well controlled. But she has been postmenopausal. Her body hasn't had hormones. Her ovaries have not produced hormones in 10 years. Sometimes just jumping someone right back into hormones isn't the best idea because their body has already gotten used to not having them. Throwing them right back into the mix of it can stir up a whole lot of symptoms that women don't want. But that's not to say that she can't do the BHRT, you know, oh, darn it, I missed my window. I can't do it. It would be maybe what this pharmacist is thinking is starting really low and then working your way up.
Well, a quarter of a milligram, though?
I mean, that's really low.
In a situation like that, you've had plenty of them like that over the years. I've had plenty of them like that over the years. So if she came to you, what would you start her at?
You know, I probably would start her maybe, like you said, 10 years postmenopausal. Doesn't look like she's having a whole lot of symptoms. And let's say her blood levels are very low with estradiol, so she hasn't had hormones for 10 years. I probably would start a little, you know, maybe not 0.25 milligrams of the Bias, maybe a little bit higher, and then work your way up. Because
so what's a little higher? I'm trying to nail you down.
I might even do like a half a milligram, you know, 0.5 twice a day. So a total of one, even though that seems really low, I do feel like, hey, you know, we're working on this relationship. It's not like, you know, let's jump into the deep end. That it's always better to do, you know, less is best, where you can do less, work your way up, as opposed to doing too much of a good thing. And then you're trying to back your way out of those symptoms.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the further they're away, the further they're away from their menstrual history, the less likely they are to bleed. Because they've been away from it for a while. But at the same time, like you said, she's been 10 years since having a period. You don't want to just throw a bunch of estrogen at her because then she will have some bleeding problems.
Or she'll get puffy. She'll feel munchy. She'll feel PMS-y. It's, you know, it's just like too much of a good thing. It's just sort of start low and work your way up if it's, you know, necessary. Let's say maybe she did have osteoporosis or bone density issues. Hormones are great to help with bone density as well as the exercise, as well as, you know, eating an anti-inflammatory diet. So there's so many other things that really would depend on what are those hormonal goals that we're looking at in this person, you know, in this individual's life.
Yeah. If her only issue is the GSM, then switching to Bias really isn't a good idea for her. It's really not going to help her if she doesn't have any of those other, you know, kind of more classic menopausal symptoms, which she doesn't, you know, really talk about. And I don't think, now, maybe like you were talking about earlier, the VAGIFEM, you know, affects blood levels, which is affecting cholesterol, maybe. If she went on the biased, the 0.25 milligrams, I think that's just a little too conservative, you know, at that point.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that would help her lipid profile. It kind of looks like you said, these aren't the units that
If she stopped the VAGIFEM, then maybe, right, those numbers could regress a little bit.
Or go up.
Yeah.
You know, estrogen is great at keeping cholesterol down.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm not saying that there's any connection to it.
I think it could just be family genetics.
No.
It probably wouldn't move either way.
I don't necessarily think so. Like I said, though, if she switched to this and then her numbers changed, good or, you know, for the better or for the worse, then you could sort of, speculate that the VAGIFEM could have contributed to those numbers. I don't think it would really have an effect on it either. I really don't. And cholesterol numbers are just a kind of a minefield of differences of opinion as far as what those numbers actually mean. ApoB, I think, is something that's pretty reasonable. And I've sort of changed my opinion a little bit about, use of statin drugs and lipid management. Because of that ApoB, like how do you get that ApoB down from a risk standpoint? But it'd be interesting to see. I just think her dose would be too low. And if she's only having the vaginal atrophy type symptoms or the incontinence, whatever it might be, the Bias in that respect is not the right choice for her.
Maybe it's not. But I liked this question because I love the bioidentical hormones, you know, Bias, you know, the estriol, the estradiol, the progesterone, the testosterone, all that stuff is really can, you know, make such good changes and be helpful, you know, to a woman's life. So I don't, you know, I do feel like any time in the game we want to work on hormones, you know, let's bring it to the table. It's just maybe start slow or kind of see what our goals are. But I think, you know, at her, you know, hey, it's been 10 years. Am I too late in the game? No, I don't think we're ever late in the game. It just depends on how, you know, how we want to facilitate that. Maybe just a low, low dose of the hormones is perfect for her. That's all her body needs.
Yeah. Yeah. All her body needs for what?
Well, depending on her symptoms. You know, maybe that little bit of biased might help her stay asleep at night. That progesterone at 100 milligrams certainly would help her from waking up in the middle of the night, which is really common with postmenopausal women. That's why when you're little, you remember your mom or your grandmother up reading in the middle of the night because they can't sleep.
Yeah. I do like the addition of the progesterone. I think that's definitely a good idea for sure. But, you know, switching away from the Vagifem, I think is a good idea, but yeah, using a bias as a replacement, I don't think is the right idea. And the dosing is not going to really quite get her there.
Yeah. So maybe not flipping it out, maybe doing a low dose, you know, the low dose bioidentical hormones, you know, the low dose biased, the 100 milligrams, which is not a low dose of progesterone. That's kind of like a size medium. That's a, you know, a good dose, maybe the testosterone and possibly switching that Vagifem out for an estriol insert instead.
Yeah. An insert or a cream?
You can do it either way. You can make an estriol like a suppository that you insert up and then they're kind of slippery and they can pop that out back out. I actually like when I do the estriol for women for the GSM is to do the applicator where you fill the applicator, kind of looks like a tampon, fill the applicator up with the cream and then you insert it into the vaginal canal. Because I do have some women where they just put it around the opening of the vaginal canal or that vaginal vault, and that's fine for more of the mild GSM symptoms or vaginal atrophy, but sometimes that doesn't go all the way up inside the vaginal vault that you really want to get way up there for those cells.
Yeah, you want to have as much exposure of the estriol to those you know, kind of deeper vaginal tissues.
But the little, you know, the little suppositories like those ones that we sell to patients that are prepackaged, you know.
Yeah, the Beswickin suppositories.
Yeah, those are estriol, and those are, like I said, a little slippery little guys, but put it in the fridge, they harden up, you insert it before you go to bed, and then you're horizontal while you're sleeping. That pretty much, you know, matriculates and you know, dissolves, and it's not going to fall out if you're going to run around.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you probably wouldn't want to do that, you know, as you're getting your day started, right? You want to do it probably while you're sleeping just to prevent any kind of, you know, issues there. But yeah, you're right. With the applicator, there's a little bit better distribution across the entire vaginal tissue that way, as opposed to, like you say, just applying it on the labia minora or majora on the outside, or just slightly on the inside. It's probably not going to, for a severe case, and I know you and I have had some severe ones over the years, like these women are sort of miserable. The commercial ones, which is why we don't use some of them, those are too strong. They burn, they, you know, cause some of those infections. So they're sort of, you know, at that point, they're sort of stuck, right? That's why the estriol is sort of like the secret weapon that, most conventionally minded, you know, gynecologists and those types of practitioners are just not really aware that it is FDA approved. It's a prescription. Just all the commercial products only use estradiol. I'm not really sure why though. Obviously it probably costs a lot of money to bring a drug to market, right? So you're, in some ways I can see why they do that because estriol is stronger. So you're going to provide more of a potential benefit in some respects, but not always each individual situation is not always the best choice.
It is, like you said, it is a prescription, but I seem to recall, you know, prescription, you know, in the United States, and I know you can find anything online, but technically it's a prescription. But I know we've gotten comments from other readers or listeners from around the world, and they'll say estriol or some of these things aren't prescriptions. So I know that you work with some pharmacists in Canada. Is estriol a prescription in Canada?
Yeah.
So it is, here.
But I think it was that there is a, but it's still the same thing. It's from a compounding pharmacy. I think we got a comment a few years ago.
Yeah.
We didn't know that there was, I think in Europe or again, I think England or something. And they said,
or Scotland or something. I can't remember.
Yeah. I think it was UK somewhere. And someone said, yes, there is an estriol branded product of some sort that is commercially available. as opposed to a compounding pharmacy. So again, when you're, you know, outside of the United States, we don't prescribe in those places. So we just don't really know what's available.
But we have listeners all over the world. Yeah, and they, so and they, anyone they, listening, they give
chime
me a shout
in,
out.
They chime in and they keep us updated. So now we're actually learning on how the medical systems work in these other countries. What do people actually have access to, which is, you know, kind of a nice little learning curve for us to sort of understand some of those things. And, you know, some maybe don't even have access to compounding pharmacies. How do you work with what you have if you don't have a compounding pharmacy? In our situation, like, we can kind of pick and choose and pick the best things, as opposed to having a limited number of options, which is what happens in a lot of places, even in whatever your insurance is going to cover or what your doctor is going to prescribe. Commercially, there's limited options. But when you bring in that component of the compounding pharmacy, then there's literally unlimited possibilities of how you can, like what the pharmacist in this situation suggesting, you know, a biased, a little oral progesterone, some testosterone. I mean, you can kind of mix and match it and completely tailor it to what the woman wants and what she needs. I think that part is really, really cool. I think that's why compounding pharmacies, I mean, we very rarely use big box pharmacies, which is just always been our preference. We wouldn't really be able to do our job that well for our patients if we didn't have access to compounding pharmacies. I think they're really important.
Oh yeah. With the compounding pharmacy, you can do any microgram, milligram, any dosing, any vehicle, you know, fillers. You have so much of a, you know, just versatility in that, rather than, you know, like, you only get 100 milligrams or 200 milligrams. Like with a compounding pharmacy, I can do 12.5. I can do 122.75. It's so versatile. And I do kind of appreciate this pharmacist here. You know, hey, let's put you on some hormones. You know, let's get started here. I think that,
just because she's 60 doesn't mean that she's
60 is young.
Yeah. Especially what we were talking about in the last episode, like what we've seen our patients, what they're capable of, what they're doing on a regular basis is really remarkable. I mean, literally in our lifetime, since I was a little kid watching, you know, Auntie Fanny and Auntie Vivi and all these, in my mind, I just think of them as being old ladies. I was just a little kid at the time, right? But they all had their walkers and their canes and all that. And now, and at that point, none of them were really, you know, relatively compared to what we're talking about. We're dealing with women that are the same age as they were, but in a completely different, physical and mental state, which is incredible. Like, it's really incredible that we've been able to watch this, that I think has sort of gotten a little bit, has kind of gone under the radar, because everyone talks about, you know, diabetes and heart disease and all these problems and how everything is, where the rates of those diseases are going up, which I certainly think they are, but there's a whole nother segment of the population where they're not succumbing to any of those things. I think that's the part, you know, it's always gloom and doom, in the news, if it bleeds, it leads, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. We're always talking the negative, but you and I, in our, you know, patient population, we see some of these amazing, amazing people doing amazing things. And none of them are superstars. None of them are professional athletes or anything like that. They're just doing their thing on a regular basis, but they're doing it at a high level for a long period of time. I have one gentleman that is an attorney, a trial attorney, and he's almost 80 years old and he goes to court on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Like, that's incredible. Like, literally, I think he's like 78, 79, and he loves to, and this is why nobody really likes to go against him, but he loves to go to trial. That's like his thing that he thrives on, and he's doing it at almost 80 years old. I mean, that, you know, when we were kids, that would have been a complete, I mean, granted, he's still an outlier, right? You know, he's still a complete outlier, but, you know, at the same time, when we were kids, that never would have really been even thought that it was possible to function that way in winning these big court cases. And he's got a really good track record of winning his cases, because he just loves he just loves trial law so much.
Yeah. Or just, we have patients that they're in their 60s and 70s and they're exercising. I mean, it's amazing. You know, they're building muscle, they're lifting weights, they're doing CrossFit, they're doing yoga. It's, you know, yoga retreats. It's really, you know, so that's why I think it's really cool to get this, you know, this reader or listener question that she says she is 60 years old, she is uber fit and she's healthy. Then, you know what? that's amazing. Yeah. That's what we want.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Now, granted, to that point, and to her, and to other ones we were talking about, it, you know, it takes a little effort to be in that position. Yeah,
like we were talking about earlier, about we got to get out for a walk, but sometimes it's, you know, getting there, some of that resistance. So,
But when you actually do it, though, once you're finished, like I heard someone, I was listening to a podcast yesterday, and I, you know, I think it might have been Joe Rogan's podcast or something, that when you, you know, there's always, I think it's sort of human nature to have that voice in your head that tells you not to want to do something, right? You know, I read a book a number of years ago, actually, when we and I were still in school, called The Pleasure Trap. Great book. I think it was written in like 2000, so can't even believe that book is 23 years old now. But he says that as a species, we do three things to, you know, our goal of being on the planet is to get our genes in the next generation for reproduction, right? That's, you know, all animals, mammals, everything. That's sort of their purpose or their biological purpose in some respects. We do three things as humans to basically accomplish that. We pleasure seek, we paint a void, or we energy conserve. Okay. Every decision we make is kind of boiled down to those three things. So if you think about it, if our exercise, intentionally having to do exercise, that's really not about your short-term survival, because you can get food and water pretty much from the faucet or from the fridge or from Uber Eats or, you know, from a restaurant or something. So it's not about your survival. So you're having to force yourself to expend energy. You know, you want to conserve energy as opposed to, you know, and then exercise can be seen as a some thrive on it. It's a pleasure source, right? The runner's high kind of an idea. Or it could be seen as, you know, you're inflicting pain on yourself, right? So it's really no surprise that only a small segment of the population actually works every day. But when you actually push through that resistance and actually do it, you always feel better about yourself, better physically and mentally, once you've actually done that and have been able to push through that resistance. I think that part is the best part.
Like you said, it's not just about exercise. Even when we're done with this podcast, we're always floating on cloud nine.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a little bit of a, you know, post podcast high a little bit, right? We're just like, oh, that was awesome, a little high five. And yeah. You know, but it again, there is like a real, you know, thing, going for a walk, sitting down to do something that, you know, these podcasts go out and, thousands and thousands of people are going to listen to the, you know, maybe not millions like some podcasts, but still, our podcast is very niched, you know, and if you do like what you hear on the podcast, feel free to share or give us a review on iTunes or Spotify or any of those platforms. We'd really appreciate that. The discipline, I don't even know it's discipline, but the effort that it takes to actually follow through with something, I think it does give you a sense of confidence and accomplishment on the inside. Like there's some good medicine there when you just kind of, you don't want to do it. You know, there's an easy way to talk yourself out of it, but just do it anyways. You always feel better. You never go to the gym or do some exercise and say, oh, I wish I wouldn't have done that today. Unless maybe you have an injury or something, then you might, right?
That's great. So when we're done with this podcast, we'll be on our podcast high.
Yeah. All right. So, anything left to wrap up about this one, or do we, you're being a little bit more, a little bit more, Switzerland. You're kind of, you know, I think her dose, the dose is too low, and I think she should switch away from the Vagifem, but I don't think the bias is necessarily the right thing.
No, I do think, you know, like I said, she hadn't been on hormones for 10 years, technically, that maybe starting off low is a good idea. I think I like the 100 milligrams of progesterone. I think she'd probably sleep really well with that. That's really great for the skin. It's great for the hair. You know, it would be, I don't know if this pharmacist does any blood work. I love doing blood work. I love doing, you know, getting that information on what those, you know, what the levels are to start with. But it did sound like the testosterone, they would add in some testosterone depending on levels. So they must be checking some of these hormones. So like I said, maybe I'm being Switzerland. You know, when it comes to the hormones, it's really an art. So when I work with my patients, I might have one patient that has a particular dose, and I have another patient that has some of the same symptoms, but they're on a completely different dose because they're all individualized. And I do have some really, really sensitive patients where like the littlest bit makes you know, if I go a little higher, it's too much for them. But then there's other patients where, if, you know, a little bit, they don't, you almost hit them with a sledgehammer. You have to go really high to really get some results or get those levels up in the blood. So everyone is different. So it might.
Yeah, and we're totally speculating. There's a lot of things that she's not putting in there that would be relevant to know, like you mentioned. And you're right. We, you know, there's a really wide expanse of human individuality. Right, you have your 80% in the middle, and you have your 10% outliers on the sensitive side, and you have your other 10% on the other side. But that's why, from a compounding pharmacy perspective, that's why it is in the best interest of the patient, because now you can tailor it. And, you know, listening and paying attention when they tell you those types of things, it's our job as the practitioner to be able to, as opposed to just everyone gets the same three doses. That's just not in the 2023. That's just not good medicine, right? Having options and being able to custom tailor something to that individual. Now, granted, that's not easy to do on a large scale, right? It does take time and effort and, you know, talking and listening and, evaluating through blood work to be able to, you know, to sort of, to pull some of those things off, as opposed to here's, you know, three doses and, you know, wish for the best kind of a thing. That doesn't really work. You and I have never really been interested in that kind of a, you know, mass production kind of an approach. That's why the compounding pharmacies are so valuable to what we do, and also to the benefit of the patient, so that it can allow them to continue what they do at the same time. So any last final comments, or we should wrap this one up?
Nope. I think this was great.
Okay. Until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Progress Your Health podcast. If you like what you've heard on this podcast, please give us a positive review on iTunes. This allows us to spread our message, grow our audience, and help more people around the world. For more information, visit our website at progressyourhealth.com.